Monday, July 20th. This is LA Podcast. I'm Alyssa Walker. We also have Hayes Davenport and Scott Frazier.
Hey, Alyssa.
How are you guys doing?
I'm doing great.
Doing well. Doing well. Big events this week with our various hosts of the podcast. Scott, you have an announcement to make, of course.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, I mean, I posted on Twitter that I was considering running against Mitch O'Farrell when his...
I was talking about how you took a bath the other
damn
day.
Damn it. I knew it and was one of the
bath,
two of those.
You used a bath bomb for the first time.
Not for the first time. Actually, this has become a real thing for me during quarantine. I'm experimenting with all the different kinds. I had a nice jasmine gardenia one. It turned the water green. I felt kind of like, you know, Ophelia among the lilies, that painting. It was nice. It was a very...
Hopefully not too much like Ophelia.
Yeah, well...
Does it irritate your skin?
It was an elegiac experience. No, it didn't. And I felt pleasantly scented for the rest of the day. For months, probably.
And this kind of thing is a great way to humanize you for when you run for city council.
Which I've absolutely not... I really have not committed to doing. I want to make that super clear.
But if you put it on Twitter, though, it's real and we'll hold you to it.
I mean, I figured I would be straightforward with people who have been asking me if I would consider it. And I've been kind of non-committal because that is, first of all, very far in the future. And second of all, it is somewhat at odds with my long-term issues with anxiety. But that being said, I have
it'll be fine.
I have a lot, obviously, of opinions about how the district should be run. So, you know, sure, I'll consider it.
I think the baths will help with the anxiety. So keep those
That's
up.
Why I'm doing
Work it,
it yeah,
on your platform. It's going to be good. Looking forward to it.
We got in a little bit of trouble last week. We took some heat for not covering the squirrel moldy jam story. That was kind of developing as we were recording.
Yeah.
And now it's
I don't think we should be taking any heat because it was the grams were literally dropping like as we were talking. So mm-hmm.
And now I sort of feel like that story is as moldy as the jam buckets themselves. It's tough to cover. It's only a week ago. So I don't know. I did all enjoy all these people bragging that they've never been.
That was pretty funny.
To Squirrel, Silver Lake people, as if you aren't just as complicit. Uh-huh.
I mean, yeah.
Isn't it really though that you tried to go and the line was too long, and then you just went somewhere else?
Yeah, that's totally right.
I used to live right across the street from Squirrel at like a marathon in Vermont, and I mean. So we would always complain that we just wanted like a coffee shop, you know, like a place where you could get coffee without having to, without it being a whole event ordeal. But yeah, like the cardamom tea cakes and things like that. They're good. They were good. I love it when things like this come out, and especially, the moldy jam is gross enough. But the other part of the story was that, so Jessica Coslow had been taking recipes, passing them off as her own, not giving credit to the cooks who were actually coming up with them, which I feel like is, I feel like you don't have to dig too deep in the restaurant industry to find that that is the case in a lot of these personality-backed places. Yeah. But I do love that, you know, when that comes out, people are like, I always hated this place. It is an interesting interpretation of the like right side of history discourse.
I think there was a few things, and you mentioned that you lived near that intersection. There is a story from Eater that was reported years ago where she calls the intersection of, is it Marathon and Virgil, like the crappy shitty corner. Yeah. Like that's my cheat.
That's right.
And like, again, like a few years ago, I guess you would read that and just, you know, read past. Some people would read past it. Some people would be very upset by that. I don't remember reading it when it came out, but I remember somebody pointing it out a few weeks ago. I don't know where. Again, like my mind is just like snippets of like Instagram stories, like flashing before my eyes. Like But somebody did share it, and then it came out again in this recent, there was a Instagram story that kind of like broke all this news. There's actually been like a account on Squirrel in particular from like Squirrel ex-employees who have been posting things for a really long time about different labor questions and things about recipes, things like that. So this is a story that's been like talked about for a while. Mm-hmm. And I guess like the breaking open of it, it was like the breaking of the mold on the jam bucket that finally got through it. But I thought there
now
was
the
like
spores
a
spores are everywhere.
They're flowing through the air. But I had just read just the week before this really great story on Jimbo Times. JT, the LA storyteller, yeah, he also has a podcast. And it was this really just really wonderful story about what the business owners on Virgil could do to make the families that still live there feel safe. Because what happens is you have these swarms of white people come and line up, not just there. There's a bunch of other new restaurants who kind of take over the sidewalk. And it actually is quite difficult to walk down that street. I mean, it's like an ADA nightmare. Mm-hmm. and then throw COVID on top of that. But it was this really impassioned call to be like, here's some simple things you could do to just make us feel more comfortable, people who live here, and not make us feel that we're being like pushed out or policed or watched, or even, you know, the displacement. It didn't really happen super fast at first, but it seems to have been accelerating over the last few months. I don't know if you've gone up and down Virgil, but there's a lot more storefronts being converted all of a sudden. Yeah. Who knows what will happen, you know, in the coming months. But a really good example was how Rick's Produce, which is across the street, which is a Latinx owned business, they give all their produce away to the neighborhood, you know, at the end of the day or the end of the week. I'm not sure how often, but hadn't seen that same kind of engagement from Squirrel. And there was an episode where somebody tagged the outside of the business, something like, "You're as bad as Trump," or something like that. So it is just, like you said, this has been building up for a long time. And there are steps you can take as white people who come into these neighborhoods to at least show that you're making an effort.
That said, I struggle with this because, like, you know, I have in the past, like, I'm sure, like, kind of subtly bragged about, like, "Oh, Squirrel, you go to Squirrel? I like the place. There's a Salvadoran place that I do like.
The Papooseria." Right down the street.
Yeah, there's a place called California Grill. Yeah, it's really, really, it's right there. Yeah. And it's delicious. And, you know, it's obnoxious as that is, like, it feels like performative in a way. But also, like, the city has created an environment where the presence of wealth and whiteness in a neighborhood is damaging.
Yeah.
Like, it is a potential concern, even if you are patronizing Latinx owned businesses, like, there is like a potential threat just from your existence nearby.
Yes.
And so ultimately, like, it's the same thing as like recycling and turning the lights off when you leave a room. Like, like, if we're just regulating consumer behavior, nothing is going to really change. It's all policy. It's like the big levers that can keep restaurants in these buildings, that can keep people in these neighborhoods. Like, it has to just go beyond the situation where just, like, if you put someone in this area, then it's an existential threat for mm-hmm. the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
It just has to be put on the people in charge, you know? Let's talk about, speaking of delicious moldy food, L.A. Alfresco Mangia.
That's a good one.
Dining under La Luna. What is the update? Alyssa, you solicited responses for people like spotting LA Alfresco restaurants around the city. The responses, you were updating on us on them throughout the last couple of weeks. They seem to be like a mix. You got a mix in terms of what you were satisfied by. Some seemed to frustrate and enrage you.
It was like one of those appetizer plates that had, you know, a bunch of salami, a bunch of cheese, mm-hmm. pickled things, and none of them. I don't know where I'm going with this. But none of them quite came together to satisfy my hunger. It was just kind of light bites.
Did you offer a gift card on the show?
I offered a gift card to the
because I missed that. I missed that, but our listeners did not miss that.
Yeah. Oh no. And I need to still award that. So if you were just looking at this through like the lens of what the attention has been of our COVID response, you would say the biggest effort is being made for LA Alfresco over the last few weeks. It's kind of changed over the last week. Now we have a poster about wearing masks. We'll talk about that later. But the amount of energy being put into LA Alfresco, I was like, okay, this must be the most exciting thing that's happening to see. This must be going on everywhere. And I haven't seen it. So I tried really hard to check out some dining corridors where this might be put into place. You look at these photos of New York, you look at these photos of even like Santa Monica, Pasadena, Culver City. Yeah, they're all, Burbank, they've all closed streets. They're making space, they're clearing out the sidewalks and making sure that people can get by. And I hadn't seen any, so I put out the call and then I went to some places to look. And the winner, and the rule is, it can't just be a parking lot that they took over because that's just they can always do that with their parking lot. And it can't just be the sidewalk because that's actually a problem, is to take over the sidewalk. And somebody did send a photo of like on West 3rd, like where the sidewalk dining had stretched so far down that they were like in front of a parking garage, like, you know, three blocks away from the restaurant or something, right? But just to take the space up. So what we have to think about is, like, are we really taking up the street? Is the city even following through on this, its huge announcement? And besides the like original one, which is very pretty at South LA Cafe, I hadn't even seen many that were inspiring or interesting or actually took use of the space. So the winner of the competition is Alex Cohen, friend of the show, who sent one from Atwater Village. So there are some right on that strip of Glendale, I think that's
what
really...
was that? What's that place called?
Bon Vivant. I wish it was an Italian restaurant. It is it? I don't know. No, it's French or something. But so they had taken up maybe not even quite a real parking space because they have diagonal parking there. So it's kind of like a diagonal couple parking spaces where they had just roped off and put some seats in the street. So we'll take that one as the winner. But then a bunch of people kept trying to send me ones. And I had to say, like, somebody sent in one that, on New York, and that's a real parklet that's been there for like 8 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a parklet.
First of all, thank you for engaging with the show. I do just want to say,
thank you for sending these to us.
Your submissions are...
They're appreciated. But I would love to say that this is like a testament of like how this is not being done. I saw one on Larchmont where it was just like police tape around one parking space. Again, they have diagonal parking. This is Larchmont.
Police tape is going to be useful there.
Yeah. That police tape is actually to keep out the people with children that they don't want walking down their sidewalks. I went up and down Hillhurst thinking that this would be a key place with all these restaurants. And you've got like people in Cafe Figaro, like, you know, with plexiglass between them crunched on the sidewalk, and nobody's using the street in any way. So I continue to say, I think there are some in the arts district, some people sent maybe. I think there are some in other parts of...
What about Black Cat? Hayes, did you ever go by there?
Parking lot.
That's parking lot.
Yeah.
But they... I question what, like, is it possible that you actually do need a special permit just to move your business into the parking lot, because restaurants need to maintain a normal number of parking spaces. Yeah. So maybe they are changing.
I think
the
that
rules
was part of the
that.
Permitting, but what I, yeah. but my question is that remains, I was starting to think of one more place that I thought somebody sent someone from, but
Victoria Krause and Casafina and Boyle Heights, which we haven't. Oh, but she said that was an alleyway parking
yeah,
lot.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I'd like to see. Yeah. But yeah, I think like this is just another point of why we've had so much attention on this. And it's saying the city is saying that it's doing something, and we don't even aren't seeing the benefit of it really in any way.
That's been one of the two big programs that Mayor Garcetti has spoken about repeatedly. The other one is slow streets. Have you guys been to any of the slow streets?
I've been to a few slow streets, but you just had your first experience, Scott. I went and saw the first ones on the west side very early on. And then I engaged with some of the Koreatown ones when they first opened, which is really just near me.
You engage with, how do you engage with the slow street other than running over the sign?
I go in the street and just see how long it takes till somebody hits me with a car. But the one in Koreatown is just 4th Street, which is, yeah, it's already like a bike street, but it's not any safer having those signs. It's a very busy street with a lot of cars on it. So I didn't see why I would, I'm not probably taking my kids to ride them around on 4th Street anyway.
In the street. I went to Los Feliz, which is one of the newer ones up in between Hillhurst and, or in between Vermont and Hoover, I guess. And I did start walking down like Melbourne Street in the road, and then doing it felt like I was being obtuse and also taking my life into my hands unnecessarily, because these are like big blocks, right? And it's
in between the
intersections, there's no real indication that cars should be doing anything differently. There are at the intersections, the signs posted that say local traffic only or drive slow or LA slow streets or whatever. But there's a lot of road in between there and cars are driving fast. And not only that, there's plenty of room on the sidewalk. So like in order to do this, I was like alone on the street. I would be walking in the road. Feels like I'm trying to make a point. And also,
that's what a lot of people are doing when they use those.
Right. And also, I mean, cars are just like buzzing by me. And I'm like, this is not safe for me. I don't feel safe.
They need like jerseys that you wear. You pick up like a jersey to walk through it, like one of those high vis.
God, remember when the LAPD wanted that?
Yeah. Oh, another great effort by LAPD. Yeah, I think. When I was doing my recon of restaurants in Los Feliz, I almost got hit by a car that was trying to avoid one of those signs. It was in the middle of Hillhurst or Vermont. I can't remember which one that says "Don't turn here," right? And because people are trying to navigate around these spaces, don't understand that like the streets are closed in the middle. Yeah, I think I rode my bike from my house to West Hollywood the other day, and just as a reminder, I hadn't like been out on my bike in a while outside of my own neighborhood, and the streets. In the neighborhoods that are already quite nice, the streets are slow and they have a lot of trees and they're not that wide and you could use them very comfortably in any condition. The streets that need to be calmed are just going to continue not to be calmed. And if you have these efforts to try to put these out there, that's great. I guess they're more in places like South LA now. They have like, you know, they're not just going in like the wealthiest neighborhoods that ask for this first on the west side. So that's good. And then you have somebody like David Rue who wants to make these permanent, which I'm not really sure what that motion was about. That was from a few weeks ago. He introduced a motion to make the slow streets permanent. But then you read down through the language and it's like, oh, this could actually just be a way to get people from not using these streets when they're using their navigation system.
Yeah, I was gonna say exactly that. Like, this is something that in Echo Park, in Hollywood, and other places has come up with astonishing frequency over the course of the past few years. This idea of cut through traffic. That was actually why David Rue wanted to kill the Rowena road diet.
That's right.
Was because of cut through traffic. So, I mean, the slow streets thing, there's not a change associated with that. You're telling people to drive the speed limit, which is not like that's ostensibly something that is already what the city should be telling them to do. But the only difference is you're saying local traffic only. And I don't even know how enforceable that is on a permanent basis. But
locals only, man. There's going to be like a surf culture in these, like on these streets. They'll throw rocks at you.
You're not from here.
There was all this discussion of, there was that video posted of those gates that are in Country Club Park where you can't actually walk through some of those streets they're not just like a gated street. They're actually, the sidewalk is also gated. So we have this kind of, now there's this effort. I think it's in Wesson's district. There's all these people who have been calling to get these gates opened. Like, those people are ever going to open those gates? I don't think they probably, you know, we've got a kind of a St. Louis gun wielding couple situation.
Yeah, I'd be careful.
I don't want those gates open. But there is, I think what people forget, that's something that reminded me about it, is there are a lot of really good examples of streets that have been slowed in LA. There's a lot of like wealthy neighborhoods that have, you know, put little parklets on the ends of and streets and turned them into cul-de-sacs. There's these like planters in a lot of streets. There's tons of good examples. It's just not in the places or the neighborhoods that actually do need them.
Yeah. And just to say one more thing about that, the Slow Streets program by design only includes these more residential type streets. It doesn't include the arterial streets like Hillhurst and Vermont. So it's only on the in-between streets. That works out okay in a neighborhood like Los Feliz, considerably less so in a neighborhood like yours, Alyssa. Like, I mean, if we start getting into like the central part of Westlake, all of those streets are arterials. So you're talking about big apartment buildings, lots of kids, way more kids than you'll find in Delray. And they have very few options for what would be considered residential streets to meaningfully allow for the safe type of playing in the street. So.
And those big arterials are the ones on the high injury network.
Yeah.
We talked about it on the show. But
right.
6% of streets in LA are where 65-70% of the injuries and fatal crashes happen. And those are, it's almost entirely yeah. on those big.
And that's where the pedestrian traffic
yeah,
is.
Yeah, let's actually
and we know
deal with that. Yeah, I mean, it's just again, like we had a moment. It was maybe a moment. It's over now. The cars are back. I mean, I don't.
Right.
We could have helped people that actually need it. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to the people who did send us emails with Alfresco. I'm sorry you didn't win. I'm very disappointed
in
myself as much as you. But Victoria Krause, we have Robin Sims, and we have Sebastian Shepard. And I'm sure some more people pinged us on Twitter.
Sorry, it's not your fault.
It's not your fault.
They don't want you to know what LA
Kiera
is.
Feldman. I'm sure there's more. But I just want to give everybody a shout out for playing this game. We'll introduce a new game. You know, this isn't a game. This is serious. This is not a game. And to Alex Cohen, someday I'll send you a gift certificate for Bon Vivant.
We thought it might be interesting to go through in a comparatively slow news week this week. City Council is in recess, kind of the dog days of summer. And I guess I'm just ignoring the fact that the pandemic is absolutely raging in Los Angeles. It is at its peak. But I can feel myself getting inured to that, especially talking about the same story every week. We hit a new high in cases this week, cases in one day. We are at the highest current level of hospitalizations that were reported yesterday on Saturday, 2,183 people currently hospitalized with COVID-19. That's very close to the limit of hospital beds in LA County. We don't know, exactly what the number is kind of fungible, but I've heard it's at like around 2,300, I think, Scott, you were saying, like something like that.
I think it's in that ballpark because we had, I think back when we were at about 2,000, that was when Mayor Garcetti was saying that there were 300 beds left. I haven't checked on the exact number, but yeah, it's right around there.
And that changes as like they built out like the St. Vincent's, like the surge unit, the convention center had beds for a while. They had the USS Mercy show up. And so like, who knows if it's more or less now than it was then. The point is, we thought it would be interesting to talk about the residents of the city have been asking our local leaders for a lot of changes to be made, both in response to the pandemic on an immediate basis and on a more ongoing basis to address the vulnerabilities that the pandemic has exposed. So we thought it's been about 4 months exactly now that we've been in this state of emergency. So let's just go through everything that the city has done. I'm really curious, like the effect of this, like if it feels like a lot as we're summarizing it, or if it feels like a little, just like compared to the need. But Scott, you have kind of put together a full summary of what the city has done. Does it include slow streets? Does it include LA Alfresco?
Actually, those did not make my list. And
those
I mean, shame on
really
me.
Helped.
Those count.
Have those
they
helped?
They do count.
Fresco erasure.
That's what they call me.
They erase themselves.
Okay, so we had on March 4th, this is the beginning of our timeline. So March 4th is when the local emergency relative to the pandemic is declared, I believe right around the same time as WHO declared that it was a pandemic. That was followed shortly after, a week later, by President Nury Martinez announcing that all...
City Council President, yes.
That all city council committee meetings for the remainder of the month of March were canceled, along with two out of the three weekly meetings. The Wednesday and Friday city council meetings for the rest of the month were canceled.
So that was all before lockdown.
It was all before lockdown.
Hmm.
At the same time, on March 11th, that was when Garcetti sent his message out to city employees and department heads saying that they needed to have a plan in place to begin teleworking. A couple days later, under the emergency that he had declared on the 4th, on March 15th, Mayor Garcetti put out an executive order halting residential evictions for non-payment of rent if the tenant could prove that it was due to COVID. March 17th, he does the same thing for commercial tenants. And then on March 19th, that's when Safer at Home is.
That's when restaurants and bars and everything closed. That was March 19th?
Yeah.
Interesting. I would have flipped the order of that in terms of...
I would have as well. I was actually pretty surprised by all of this. And also seeing that at the time that Nury Martinez said city council couldn't meet anymore, city employees were still showing up to city hall every day.
Yep.
Every day, yeah. So
it took a while, even after Safer at Home, state employees like had to go to their offices, people that worked for members of the state legislature.
Yeah.
As I recall from conversations with people that I know that that work at City Hall for several departments. So Garcetti put out that thing about department heads, get a plan for remote working in place. I think a lot of them were continuing to work like throughout the month of March. Because they were still developing that plan for how they were going to actually accomplish their work remotely. So March 19th, Safer at Home. March 23rd, Nury Martinez cancels the Tuesday city council meetings for the remainder of the month of March. So at that point in time, city council now has not met for a couple of weeks. And they've cleared their entire schedule going forward. There are no meetings scheduled for April. And Angelenos freak out because there's clearly a lot of work to be done and city council is basically taking an extended vacation in the middle of this very serious health crisis. So then in the interim, you have a sole representative of the city council, council member Mike Bonin, saying that he would show up. He doesn't care what he has to wear in terms of PPE. He'll be there. And then you have a reversal on March 27th, where despite Nury Martinez just canceling everything, then she says that they will actually meet the next day. They'll do a Zoom meeting the next day. So March 28th is the first time that city council meets following the declaration of the local emergency.
So that was March. You can sort of tell what the plan was, right? And we were talking about this at the time, I'm pretty sure. But just like emergency period, all power just goes to the mayor's office and the city council can basically like shut down completely. And I think as we'll see over the next few weeks in April, I think a lot of stuff that normally the city council would have been doing, the mayor just did unilaterally, which is what they wanted. They were more than happy to just place all that power in the mayor's hands, right?
That's correct. So the last thing that happened in March on the 31st, they did pass their only ordinance in March, which was basically a restatement of the eviction moratorium that had already been enacted by the mayor. That was
by the mayor.
And I left out a big one that the mayor did on, let me get the date. So on March 23rd, Garcetti had gone ahead and used the expanded power provided to him by Governor Newsom to suspend the enforcement of the Ellis Act locally.
Right.
So the only ordinance that we get from city council in that first meeting that they had on the 28th, the only ordinance we get is a full-on restatement of no eviction for residential non-payment of rent based on COVID, no eviction for commercial non-payment of rent based on COVID, no enforcement of the Ellis Act. So again, things that the mayor had already done. That was it for March. After that, though, on April 10th, we get a couple more new ordinances. We get expanded protections for grocery workers, basically like their frontline employees during the COVID period, making sure that their employers are providing for expanded protections for them in the workplace. We have also on that same day, the paid leave program that this one I feel like was the precursor to other things that we were actually going to see become thematically more relevant. But this is like expanding who can actually take sick leave. So grocery workers, first responders, et cetera. So then from that point on, like there's not a ton that gets actually done. Like we have this gap basically where like I think we had talked about on the program, there are a lot of different things that keep coming up, like right to return for local workers that ends up getting passed, I think, in early May.
Right. For a certain set of workers.
Right. Specifically for like workers at the airport, for hotel workers. It's people who are represented in large part by the union Unite Here, who had been a major part of this Healthy LA coalition, but a lot of the other members of that coalition did not receive the same benefits. We saw, for example, restaurant, like smaller restaurant workers or smaller restaurant owners saying, this will bankrupt us, this will put us out of business permanently. We do see being passed later in May a temporary restriction or cap on the delivery fees that can be charged by app services, because those have become so integral to the functioning of restaurants that did not have in-house delivery available to them. That is temporary. That only extends through the end of the emergency period, whenever that might end. Then we get in July, we get the Emergency Renter Relief Program, which is now, of course, the lottery program that is using federal aid money to pay for a portion of rent for certain low-income houses if they are successful in navigating this lottery program. These are basically it.
Huh.
That's like 4 months worth of work.
It is underwhelming. It feels like less than what we, certainly all the different things that we talked about. Like, you know, you talked, for example, about protections, like right of return protections for workers. That day, I remember the day that passed was like one of these 11-hour council meetings where they were talking about further expanding eviction protections, basically making it so you couldn't evict anybody during the emergency period for anything beyond like violent crime and things like that.
Right.
And also expanding what you could, like what kind of buildings you could freeze rents on, which the city can't technically do, but they would ask the state for the privilege to freeze rents on non-rent controlled buildings. But neither one of those passed. So a lot of oxygen did get taken up by these votes that didn't end up going through. And I think that in a way makes it seem like the city council was, I mean, you know, it was work. They were doing things.
Yeah. So this is wholly just looking at
just what passed
ordinances. Yeah. Ordinances that are currently in effect.
And this most recent one, the rent relief lottery, let's talk about that. It's $103 million, I think. And it is on a lottery system. Each family or each household that wins, but first you have to be declared eligible. You have to only be making a certain amount of income. And if you are entered and you win, you get $2,000. So that it can help about 50,000 households. So more than 200,000 people this week applied. So it means that about one quarter of the applicants will get this measure of relief. I would say that's possibly less than I would have thought would apply for something like this. But it is, you know, it's a process to send in this app. You know, it's like there are hurdles in place to even applying. And you have to assume that a lot of the households that applied will be declared ineligible for one reason or another.
Right. It's like, well, and also, did you see Santa Monica's program?
No.
Santa Monica's program gives up to $5,000 per household for up to 300 households, you know, very much smaller city, but $5,000.
Yeah.
It could do something, perhaps.
Right.
If you were in that kind of. And
that's really why for LA City, they've been, I mean, our city council has been laser focused on, I mean, and not, certainly not wrongly, on getting more federal aid. They've been trying to say, like, in order to adequately spread the money according to the need in the city of LA, we just need more than $100 million. The question of whether or not that is actually coming is, you know, a separate issue.
The thing I continue to be confused by is the Fed, I think, is part of the CARES Act, but certainly as part of like the whole package of aid, announced these loans, these low interest loans that they were giving out to large cities and counties. And I believe LA City is eligible for like $1.1 billion in loans or something like that. But I've heard people in the city attorney's office and just saying, like, we can't borrow our way out of this crisis. But we are borrowing. Every case of need that you don't throw money at right now is a loan. And right. It's an incredibly high interest loan. Like that ends up being so much more expensive later. So yeah. Anything we can spend this money on, anything whether it's like COVID related or in terms of like financial relief, we absolutely, not only can we borrow our way out of this crisis, we have to either way. So we might as well take the lowest interest rate, which is from the Federal Reserve. Like, let's get this money. Let's flood the city with this money and we will save money later.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. The impact of not getting the money that we can as cheaply as we can now and using it to fund programs that will save lives, and not only save lives, but also materially improve the conditions of people's lives a year from now. By not doing that, we are putting ourselves in an even more dangerous position. It is hard to say, looking at this timeline of city council action, that they've done everything that Angelenos could reasonably expect them to have done. Taking a month off in the middle of a pandemic that is worse now than it was when we started Safer at Home is bad. Like, it's just bad on every level. It looks bad. It feels bad as an Angeleno. You're in the middle of a moment where not only do we have this pandemic, but we also have the uprisings against state violence. People are more engaged in city politics than they ever have been, probably within the last like 70 or 80 years in this city. And city council has not been happy about that engagement, and now they're just like, oh yeah, we'll revisit this. Let's table this whole pandemic thing and come back to it next month.
I mean, you're just making me, the timeline is like, I was kind of like staring into space as you were just talking, because it was just like, what could we have done differently? And it's so clear, if we were going to give this relief, of course, we didn't know how long it was going to last, but we could have mobilized the relief right away and made it so people could actually stay home for comfortably for a month if they needed to. And that's not what happened. You had wealthier people being able to stay home, no problem, up until now, I guess. And you have this like real insistence, and we still don't really know where it came from, to reopen. And we don't, you know, people were asking kind of in the national media if those protests of the reopening people affected somehow Newsom's, or, you know, really like complete 180 to reopen the state and allow these things. You know, there was a story out this week by Ron Lynn, I think, at the LA Times, that he ignored the metrics that were put forth. And then that gave us permission, I guess, to move forward with our reopenings. But I still don't really understand where the pressure to reopen things is coming from, and what, why that happened so quickly, and who we blame for that part.
I mean, you have to look at Eric Garcetti locally, right? He, like we were talking about with the timeline, he has been the driver of the city's response to the pandemic. He has an expanded breadth of power in the emergency period that he declared, and he's been using it. So the question that I keep coming back to, he's speaking a lot before the media, but the question that I keep coming back to is, who is his audience as he's talking about these things, as he is deciding to open or keep things closed? What exactly is, what is his aim? I mean, that's something that we talked about, Hayes, back when he was first considering a presidential run. Like, is his audience actually Angelenos? He obviously is not. He's not stupid. He knows that people here are quite mad at him and the way that he has been handling this. But is he even talking to us, or is he looking over our heads at some other national audience, and how might his decision-making be affected by that? We know, of course, that he, or at least we strongly suspect that he intends to be part of whatever Biden administration might come out of November's election. So, you know, I don't know. Is it just that he wants to seem business friendly? Is that just an important consideration for whatever coalition Joe Biden needs to put together to win this, or that?
Oh yeah, so you brought this up before, and I think that is like maybe more to it than we think, and we've never really talked about that connection where he's still Joe Biden's campaign co-chair, right? Do you get kicked off of that during your emergency COVID response? It's probably
he was on Jake Tapper today. I haven't watched it yet, but like seemingly on there mostly as, you know, they asked him questions about LA, but he was deferring a lot of those questions to like Trump's responsibility in this. So when he goes on national TV, he seems to be mostly doing it as a campaign surrogate for Biden. You know, I think a lot of it comes down to the fact, like, nobody has been as agile at fundraising in the history of LA mayors as Eric Garcetti. You have Richard Reardon, who was very rich and just like spent his own money on his campaigns. But Garcetti goes and gets it from other people. One of the people that facilitates that, actually the primary person who facilitates that fundraising, is a guy named Rick Jacobs, who was in the news this week for repeatedly sexually harassing a member of the mayor's security team. And I have also heard from other people that this was an issue with Rick Jacobs. But Eric Garcetti has let into his circle people who are incredibly good at massing money from wealthy interests. And that has, I think, now become sort of an anchor for him in a number of ways. These people are now in like the primary part of his circle, and he's tied to whatever behavior they're up to, whether it's fundraising malfeasance or sexual harassment or whatever. And also those special interests come calling. They say, hey, we invested in you. Like, and now our business, like, I'm sure there are thousands of different businesses in the city that are now saying like, hey, we're your partner and you're failing us. You need to let us operate again. And that's who he's beholden to because of all the money he's taken, instead of residents of the city. There were polls right around the time we started reopening that were like 75-25. We're opening too fast. this is going too quickly. It was not, I mean, like,
yeah, at the time. I mean, it wasn't even like in hindsight. It was people saying, no, right now we are telling you. I mean, this, it's just, I can't even believe, just as, and we've talked about the school thing, and I'm just so, it's going to be some really gut-wrenching decisions for these parents over the next month as we decide what we're going to do with our children. And yeah, our economy is going to collapse because of that. It's not, it's not because of, and this is a nationwide thing, I guess, because then you're still going to have other cities where I see people, you get a form sent home for your kid that's like, my kid is allowed to go back to school, and I'm saying that I, you know, the school is not responsible if they catch COVID. I mean, and then we're starting to see here in LA, in LA County, they just reported that the syndrome that some kids are getting that is like Kawasaki syndrome is on the increase here in the city as well. So we are putting our kids in danger. I mean, because we didn't take care of this at the beginning, and
Much more so our teachers and much, parents.
And yeah, and I was just going to say, it's like a cascading effects type of situation. And I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to how this happened, but there's no way out from this now. I mean, there's really no way out.
I cannot help but look at, I mean, I've been watching a lot of Garcetti's media appearances, that he live streams on Twitter as well. And it's hard for me to get beyond the perception that this is a person that has the capacity for a really disciplined messaging. And at the beginning of the pandemic was doing quite a good job of staying on message, being coherent in what he was telling people to do. If you look at the recent weeks, it's not that he's not disciplined in his messaging. It's that the messaging has totally changed and now has become more about, as far as I can tell, self-protection than
masks.
Shepherd Fairey posters.
No, I mean like protecting himself personally.
Oh, oh sure. Yeah.
Like everything that too. You know, like he will be asked in many different ways the same question. He'll have Claudia Pasciuta from KNX 1070 ask him, you say that you're following the data. You keep saying data, data, data. We're doing things in a data-driven way. But when you reopened, lots of people were saying that it was way too fast and that the results were going to be bad. And that's what happened. So how do you claim that you are doing things in a data-driven way? And his response will be, we are following the data. We are doing this. So it's like, It's all, as far as I can tell, about limiting what can be said of his performance. I mean, there's not really, I don't know, like it just seems like in the months, cut like the whatever 4 months that we have before November, it's all about just providing a sufficient smokescreen or sufficient doubt that he could have done anything differently or that he could have been expected to do more or otherwise than he did in his capacity as mayor, that his reopenings were grounded in scientifically gathered data as opposed to what Alyssa said, just like, or Hayes, what you said about just businesses coming to him behind the scenes and saying, I'm losing my shirt. I need you to let me reopen now. And then when the governor comes out and says that he's closing the things that the mayor just reopened, Garcetti's response is, I have been in lockstep with Gavin Newsom, right, and this was a decision that we made jointly, which clearly defies any semblance of logic that you might try to apply to it. So, because
other cities didn't do it. San Francisco didn't do it. A lot of Bay Area counties did not open to the full extent that they were allowed to under the state standards.
It's like he would like to be able to say, as a member of the Biden administration, we did things that, you know, in whatever meetings he's having, fundraising events, et cetera, we did what business asked of us. We opened these things. And then also to be able to say publicly, I just did what the data said. I just, you know, I'm a technocrat. I follow science. Science is real, you know, that kind of stuff. That seems like the only way that you can split the difference between the egregiously dangerous positions that he's taken in the past 2 months and the answers that he's given to questions asked of him, which don't ever seem to address the meat of the problem.
That also gets to, I think, this feeling of like, that's it. That's everything that was done during the pandemic. We have spent so much time on defense, and everyone who like works in any kind of like advocacy in LA, like knows this feeling, like exerting so much energy just to get things to stop damage from being done, just to get things back to the way they were. There were people like screaming about like, you have to reclose business. Mm-hmm. People saying, no, don't increase the LAPD budget right now. Like, energy, so much energy has been spent just getting things back to where they were a few weeks ago, a few months ago. And that feels like something, like the city creates this effect where it feels like a victory when it happens. But really all you've done is like turn back the clock a tiny bit. You haven't created any like an improved situation at all. You just stopped damage from happening. And the gradual trajectory of that cycle is just things getting worse,
yep,
basically. We want to quickly highlight two stories. There was a lot of interesting stuff this week around former city council president Herb Wesson. He yesterday went to an outdoor Black Lives Matter LA and People City Council meeting where they talked about reimagining public safety. He and Councilmember Mike Bonin and Councilmember Marquise Harris Dawson were all there. They have been in support of reimagining what LAPD is and presumably decreasing the size of LAPD, although they haven't really articulated a clear vision for that. But they, Herb Wesson and Dr. Malina Abdullah, who leads Black Lives Matter, were hugging. They are clearly, at least in public, like they are partners on this effort. He was also advocating for her to become the dean of the new Department of Ethnic Studies at Cal State LA, which a lot of people are pushing for. She is a professor at Cal State LA and has done a lot of work to create this department, has been advocating for it for a long time. There are lots of people fighting for her to be dean, and Herb Wesson to get on board with that is a big deal. At the same time, there was a really interesting article by Cindy Chang in the LA Times, which was about Chief of Police Michael Moore went to the LA Times editorial board and basically said he wants more freedom to fire officers, which he doesn't really have. And to a large extent, that is true. And a big reason why that is true is something called Charter Amendment C, which we've kind of glossed over on this show in the past, but it was passed in 2017. Basically what it was, it tricked a lot of people when it was on the ballot. When an officer is found, is going to be disciplined, he goes before something called the Board of Rights. And before 2017, that Board of Rights was three people, two officers, and one civilian. And this movement, Charter Amendment C, was to give officers the option of an all-civilian Board of Rights. And the campaign was around, like, let civilians decide what happens, yep, to officers. Don't let officers police themselves. Seems like reform. But this Charter Amendment was coming from the police union, because they knew that studies showed that civilians are more lenient on officers than other officers are. And the chief legislative analyst did a study of these votes, and the civilian, it's remarkable. The civilian in basically every case where there was any like division in the decision of what would happen to an officer, the civilian was more lenient. It's like, it's incredible, yeah, how consistent, yep, it is. Not only was the police union behind this, they partnered with the city council. The city council voted to get it on the ballot. It would, like, it didn't come from outside. The city council put it on. Every single member of the city council supported it, except one. Guess who?
Bonin.
Incorrect.
Melissa, got a guess?
Who could it be? You've got me.
It's your next guess.
Dawson.
Harris Dawson. Oh. Correct. Who had formerly been the head of the Community Coalition, which is one of the big nonprofits in the city that was against Charter Amendment C.
So what if I was like Buscaino?
Every other council member supported it. Council District 7 was empty at that time. That was the same election that Monica Rodriguez got elected. So she wasn't involved in it either way. But Herb Wesson was the person that put that through for the most part. Like, he shepherded it onto the ballot and passed it. And Garcetti supported it as well. Relevant in this article because Chief Moore says that he just declared an officer out of policy for a shooting and recommended that that officer be fired. And then that officer went before this new board of rights. Mm-hmm. You have to assume that the officer chose the civilian board, and the board of rights went against the chief decision and has decided not to fire that officer. We don't know the details, but it's very likely to me that this was the officer who killed Kenneth French in a Costco just a little over a year ago. Officer Salvador Sanchez was hit in the head by Kenneth French, pulled his gun and shot this man, a disabled man, Kenneth French, and also shot both of his parents and put them in the hospital. And it seems like he might be able to keep his job because of Charter Amendment C. So as we're talking about the city council, like, partnering with BLM on this issue, Black Lives Matter LA was as outspoken as any other group against Charter Amendment C. Like, there's atoning to be done, and we are still paying for that decision in terms of the lack of accountability that officers face.
And it's so, I mean, I think you have brought up in particular, Hayes, that there is never that kind of atonement. There's never that kind of accountability where city council members don't say, I have been persuaded by the public outcry and by the popular movement, like, or something like Black Lives Matter, that I was on the wrong side of this before, and I need to rethink or change my actions. And this is an example of the harm that's been done by my office. I mean, any harm that's done by the office is kind of also an example of the good that you could do if you were if you were so inclined. What we get instead is, you know, this sort of like mantle claiming where they are saying, I have always been on the right side of this. I've always been fighting for this thing. Wesson did a very similar, I mean, he kind of had his like Twitter thread where he was like, we need to cancel rent. We need to do this. He like is using a lot of very timely language about like what should happen within the city of LA. But this is a man who was the council president for what, 6, 7, 8 years, was mm-hmm. the most powerful person in LA city government and used that power to do things like change the charter to make it easier for criminal cops to keep their jobs. No mention of that. No mention of we need to undo these things that I helped do, that I was instrumental in carrying over the finish line. Just this sort of airy, idealized version of who he is as a politician.
And update on the Andres Guardado shooting, the 18-year-old security guard who was shot by the sheriff's department in Gardena last month, shot and killed. This is sort of, I guess, what we get for accountability in the county. A captain in the sheriff's department named John Bircher.
Jesus. Like, incredibly on the nose.
It's just the worst novel that we live in. This is a very close advisor to Sheriff Alex Villanueva, posted on Facebook in a conversation about Andres Guardado that he chose his fate. And like, why don't you care about these other victims of crime? This teenager was someone who chose his fate. And there was a deserved outcry because of that. And the captain has been removed as a chief of staff. He was chief of staff for Sheriff Villanueva, is being removed and reassigned to the East Patrol Division, which is like great, amazing. I like, who knows if he'll actually like be on patrol But like, that's what we want. Now we want this guy out on the streets interacting with residents. That's all we have to talk about this week. All we have time to talk about, but we will be back next week on LA Podcast. Thank you so much to Brian Holmes for producing the show. Thank you to Scott and Alyssa. Thank you to you for listening. We'll be back soon. Bye.